I'm going to bring my guest up right away. Today's date, by the way, ladies and gentlemen, is the 10th of March 2008, and it is getting close to the end game here for all of us with the financial system. And I believe Purim should be brought up today in our conversations with Muhammad, because it's just on our doorstep. And it's funny that all these terrible events seem to happen around the Jewish holiday of Purim. But I don't think that's a coincidence. But we're going to bring Muhammad up and talk about some very important issues pertaining to the gold markets and the credit markets, and just the general cascading that is going on around the world in financial markets. Muhammad, are you with me?
I am indeed, Darrell. How are you?
Very well, thank you, Muhammad. Thanks for coming back again. You know, your broadcasts here are important for me, because what happens after our discussions is most of the things I'm aware of that we talk about, but it always piques my interest in new areas when I start listening to the way we investigate things. And one of the things I just brought up with you is about gold and how the reaction that gold has been having lately. It's been a thwarted reaction in most instances, because last week, for example, all the base metals, copper, aluminium, all of the basic tradable base metals saw huge increases in their base price against the dollar, as did palladium and platinum and the rest. Gold, on the other hand, once it reached that 990 mark, fell. Now, we're talking about some of the worst news to have come out of the United States in the last, even before 2001, and gold actually fell on the news. And so I decided with you that it would be a good idea to discuss the manipulation of the gold market and in the interest of people to, you know, understanding what the importance of gold is in the world's financial system. You want to give us a little thumbnail sketch of some of the early history, and I'll try to interject some of the things I know about it.
Okay, Darrell. Well, it is very different to all the other commodities, as you said, and the reason for that, as should be fairly obvious to everybody listening, is that gold, of course, historically was money. It was the actual medium of exchange, and what happened now, at some point in history, it takes quite a bit of dates to give everybody the spot on, but as a thumbnail, we'll do it in a thumbnail, which is probably the best way for people to think about it anyway, is that we went through a transition from gold being the store of value and the medium of exchange. And when we say medium of exchange, though, it's literally, rather than swapping chickens for apples, we swap chickens into gold and then swap the gold at a later date for apples. So it's a store of value, a place where, you know, gold originally had this position in society throughout the world of being something that we would actually do half a bit of direct barter with. We'd actually store our half of the barter, the sale of our chickens, in some gold, which we could take and complete the barter at a later date for different types of products.
Well, isn't it interesting, too, that the group we've been trying to expose the world to here and have them understand the criminality of this group have been involved in the gold markets for hundreds of years, if not millennia. Now, let's take a look back at when Shakespeare was writing about the Shylock in Italy. We know that Florence and Milan and Venice were in back in the early Renaissance were the centers for commerce coming out of Italy. Rome had fallen, and their northern cities were their commerce centers into Europe. But we also know that the Medici fortune made on trade, but trade also with financing by specific groups of goldsmiths. And we know that Catherine de' Medici carried her entourage with her into France and in her union with Charlemagne. Now, with her came her trading goldsmiths as well, and they had already figured out that fractional reserve of gold was a very easy way for them to make large sums of money. You want to talk a little bit about some of the goldsmiths' methods of earning usury on reserves that actually didn't exist in relation to the money they had out there?
Well, what's happened, Darrell, obviously sort of, I'll fill in a bit in the middle that you're discussing, but what's happened is we've gone historically from having gold as that medium to to now having paper money, and paper money even becoming electronic credits.
Mm-hmm.
In each case, they're fulfilling the same function. Now, what happened in the middle is this phrase which people like to bandy around called fractional reserve. Where did it start? Well, it started from the following. Say if you built a ship, and I wanted to buy that ship from you, and in old English money, it cost £100.
Yep.
What would happen is that I would actually have £100 in weight. The reason why the English currency is called a pound is because it meant that if you had a £1 note, a note for £1 issued by the Bank of England, you could originally, before we got fractional reserve, you could originally exchange that note for £1 in weight of gold at the Bank of England. So it was a bank note that actually represented real gold behind it. And this is the way that paper money started to come into being. Because what now happened, Daryl, is that I wanted to buy a boat from you for £100. Rather than me going out there and getting a couple of horses and filling the saddlebags with £100 in weight of gold, I could actually turn up to you with banknotes, 100 of them, or maybe even other denominations, 20 that were £5, exchangeable for £5, whatever, and I could give you banknotes that you could take down to the Bank of England, and you could redeem at the gold desk, the gold counter in the Bank of England, physical gold. And in theory, English law to this day still allows you to do that. But what happened was that we went from it being a pound in weight. There was an interesting device which came into being, which was a pound in value. And they actually separated a pound in weight from a pound in value. And what happened was that the Lombardy Jews, we have a place in the city of London called Lombard Street.
Right.
And that was where the Jews of Medici, of Lombardia, who'd had experience in that area, after they'd convinced the Pope to allow them to issue bills of exchange, the current lading bills, etc., that we have today, that they were started in Lombardy 800 years ago, and they got a special permission from the Pope to allow Jews to deal in interest. So what they realized, these Jews, was that these pieces of paper that were circulating round, they could actually issue more pieces of paper than we actually had physical gold.
Because not everybody came for their gold at the same time.
Very rarely would, because people realized, Darrell, especially when it came to big items, like buying a ship for £200, I think the Mayflower cost £220 or something like that. Who wants to walk around carrying £220 in weight in gold? You now have the certificates. You could take those to anybody. You know, if you had £201 and £221 notes, as the construction company behind the Mayflower up in Grimsby or Hull or wherever it was, you could actually just take those pieces of paper yourself and redeem them for goods elsewhere, and they became a common currency. So where people had psychologically been used to having the metals to trade, they began to accept these pieces of paper because they knew any time they wanted to, they could jump on a horse, make their way down to the Bank of England and swap them at the gold counter. So just the knowledge that the gold was there was sufficient. And of course, then what happened was these banks that were accepting the papers and lending them out and doing whatever types of business they were doing with them, they turned around to the Bank of England and said, you know, sometimes we have people who arrive late after 3 o'clock. As we know, banks have a shut-off time. And they said, you know, we knew this messenger was on his way, but his horse became sick and he had a £1 note with him. So we didn't get to put that £1 note for loans overnight. We didn't get to lend it. Even though we know it's in the money supply, it hadn't arrived. And they got permission from the Bank of England to put into their registers the value of up to 1/8 of 1% of the total amount of gold and other assets that the bank was holding.
So that's called their float.
Yeah, well, that was the first fractional reserve. And And when permission first came for it over 100 years ago, Daniel, it was only 1/8 of 1%. And it obviously...
So what you're saying is that's the camel's nose under the tent.
Precisely. That is the camel's nose. Because what happened, of course, ladies and gentlemen, is that that ate eventually. So they said, look, we know there's a quarter out there of a percent, then 0.5%, then 1%. And eventually, under prior to the new capital accord coming into place, in the original capital accord, the bank capital management, banks were allowed, as was famous fractional reserve, 10 times the value of their deposits. So we started at 1/8 of 1%, and then ended up at 1,000%. So eventually, the camel's nose became the camel's hump, became the camel's herd.
That's right, yeah, the whole herd under the tent. Now let's go for a moment now. We've got the gold in the treasuries, and we had Fort Knox, of course, supposedly loaded with the largest gold reserve in the world. We've got the Russians with gold. We've got everybody with gold. Now, in the last... since the 80s, since 1972, when gold was no longer backing any of the currencies after the Bretton Woods Accords, and that was actually done because Charles de Gaulle in France and the Bank of France decided they knew that the Americans were actually playing fast and loose during the stagnation period of the 70s from the bills coming due from the Vietnam War. So they said, well, we're going to exchange our paper for gold. And so they came to the gold window in America with their credits, and the gold people in America said, wait a minute, if the French do this and then a couple of more do it, we're going to be in trouble, because we've actually said we've got more gold, we've got more paper representing gold than we have gold to back it. And so basically what happened is that they've got $100 million worth of gold, let's say, for example, and they've got 10 times that amount of actual paper that says gold is behind it. And so...
I believe it was Nixon, wasn't it, who had to throw his hands up and come...
That's right. He said the French kicked it off, but it had that spread, there'd have been a meltdown in the 70s. So what they said was, okay, what we're going to do is instead the backing of all the world's currencies is going to be the dollar. And that the dollar is going to be secured through Fort Knox's gold reserve. And that everybody will have some sort of peg. If you're doing international trade of any type, you will be pegged to the dollar. Now, the communist countries stayed out of the system. The ruble would not exchange. And the Chinese actually were an internal organization. So you would have to get different terms from them. But the dollar became the de facto gold currency in the world. But yet there was no gold behind the dollar in the amounts that were being claimed. So we already started off in the 70s with a terrible fraud. Now, as we move through the time here, Muhammad, this fraud becomes even more pronounced, because the dollar now becomes gold, supposedly as good as gold. There's a saying in America, sound as a dollar. There couldn't be anything more untruthful than that statement. But as we get back into the 80s and 90s, where the money supply around the world is growing exponentially, the banks have to justify having the ability to write their own increases in money that's not backed by anything. So what are you talking about now? What do they do with how do they square that circle? And you talk about this fractional reserve, where they went from 1/8 all the way up to 1,000 times. That wasn't enough, because isn't it true that fiat currencies need an ever-increasing amount to stay solvent? In other words, you have to keep puffing the system up and making new credit in order for the thing not to collapse. Am I correct?
Well, that's to do with how the money's put into supply. Fiat currencies, you don't have to keep pumping up. The reason they have to keep pumping them up now is because it's put out as a debt. And because the debt has to be paid back, it's a very simple formula. If the money supply equals a debt, yeah, so M equals D, a debt, mm-hmm. The money that's in circulation is a debt, and that debt has to be repaid with interest, and here's the crux of the matter now, at rate R, then actually the money supply has to increase by I, a rate of inflation, to pay the R. So you basically you have to keep printing the new money interest.
That's right.
In order to pay, repay the...
Because the money to pay interest has to be created so that the system does not become out of balance, because that interest has to come from somewhere. Under a normal system that would not be debt-based, somebody's bad luck would have to pay off that loan. It would have to come from someplace else within the system.
Well, the interesting thing is that if we put money out as a credit rather than a debit, so there's no interest to pay on it in the money supply,
mm-hmm.
you would actually end up having a fixed size money stock that didn't need to increase, which is the same as gold, if you like, this idea that we historically had a fixed amount of gold. And one of the things that our banker friends, our Jewish banker friends, understand is that if we take gold out of circulation, we have an economy with, say, a million gold coins in it, and the economy is stable, it's in a form of equilibrium, money is exchanging hands at a fair rate, people are exchanging for goods and services, so nothing is out of balance in the money system. If you then sort of put your hand in there and start pulling money out from supply, so we have an economy which is in equilibrium with a million gold pieces, and we pull out 50,000, what you'll see happening with the shortage of purchasing power, the shortage of money in supply, is that, you know, bread stays on shelves a bit longer, milk starts to turn sour before it gets sold. People sell less because there's slightly less money in circulation. And these guys observe this.
Well, this is an important concept, because I'd like to bring that back later with these credit market shrinkage right now, where nobody can go out and get these short-term loans. This same event is happening at the same time central banks are actually pumping in more money. So that's going to sound like a contradiction in terms. They're pumping in money, but yet in the hands of the public, they're getting less of it. So what we've got here is something similar happening, where milk is spoiling on the shelves, bread is staying longer. But go ahead with this.
So that's the shortage of purchasing power, and that's one type of economic problem. And what these guys did is, obviously, because they understood the power of that with gold and how to withhold gold and therefore cause demand for the purchasing power, when they transferred over into a banknote system, they simply applied the same rules, the same manipulations to the papers. So these guys who were manipulating today, Darrell, manipulated gold when it was actually pure gold, and they did that for centuries, millennia maybe, and when it became paper that was backed by gold, they'd manipulated there. So this isn't something brand new.
But then, Muhammad, like I said, in 72, it became the dollar that was the actual value storage.
Well, the interesting thing was that what they said with the dollar, what happened was that when Nixon threw his hands up in the air and he said, look, I haven't got enough gold to back it, but what I do have is the most productive economy in the world. And so I give solemn oath as president of the country with the most productive economy in the world that we will back our currency through our production. So people accepted that promise, basically. It was a production-based promise. To say there was still value in the dollar because we're just producing so much out of the ground. We've got oil. We're manufacturing cars. I mean, America led the world in absolutely everything.
Well, at the end of World War II, we represented 51% of all financial transactions in the world were American. So that meant 51% of all the activity coming out of any kind of money was going through the dollar system. We had half the world's economy. As it stands right now, we're at 11%. So if you want to take a look at the drop from that till now, and that's with an increase in our population. So the amount of spending power the Americans have lost since the end of World War II is a shocker. I mean, we can get into that at another time, but go ahead with the story. This is astonishing stuff.
So basically, we have this promise, and the world accepted the promise of the American economy, and thereby backing the dollar, and thereby we became free for the first time ever from gold. And there was an international set of agreements whereby everybody abandoned the gold standard. Not in the old sense of the post-Second World War direct link, but also what we had under Nixon was the abandonment of the monetary value.
That's right, and you could not any longer come in and exchange whatever note you had for actual physical gold. That was made unavailable to anybody unless you were holder of a certificate that said you could. In other words, those certificates were removed from circulation. Some people still have what they call a silver certificate, which by law, if you come into a treasury, they have to give you the value of that dollar bill in silver, because it says so on the front of the note. But what you'll notice, ladies and gentlemen, on your dollar bill, it says Federal Reserve Note. It does not say that it says it's backed by the good faith of the American government. It does not say it's backed by anything other than good faith. Now, what that means is that there's only a promise involved here. Nothing that they can exchange to you physically that proves its value. Nothing.
And strangely enough, Darrell, because of the way English law was encoded, we have a concept in English law of something which is entrenched. If something is entrenched in law, it goes back to the hundreds and hundreds of years, no government is actually allowed to overturn it. So it's supposed to be, I suppose, a bit like the Constitution in the States, you know, that the president is supposed to enforce and live within the framework of the Constitution, a fact that Mr. Bush seems to have difficulty with. But we have a similar idea here where the government isn't allowed to overturn it. So, strangely enough, you can, in theory, still change your £10 note for £10 value of gold, because the government wasn't actually allowed to overturn the law. So the law still stands, technically, in the UK.
Well, I'd like to see that happen.
Well, I know people... That's pretty good, Darrell, because I know people have actually turned up to try and enforce their constitutional right and have been front-marched out by the police and the SAS or whatever. One of them was actually a nun. She decided to go down there to find out whether it was real, and they had the difficult situation of trying to throw a nun out of the Bank of England. I wish I'd had a camcorder for that one.
Well, now what we've got, though, see, now we move forward into the 90s when the banks made agreements internationally to take this undervalued gold out of their own vaults. And this was internationally. They all did it. The Americans, the Canadians, the Australians, the British, everybody started saying, we're going to disgorge from our treasuries tons of our gold holdings, because at the time, ladies and gentlemen, an ounce of gold was hanging on to about a $250 an ounce price. And gold was seen as a bad asset to hold. Well, these large gold sales, as I mentioned to you, Muhammad, earlier in our private conversation, never seemed to end up in anybody's hands that you could track. They would say, we've just put on the market 500 pounds of gold or whatever in this period. Many of those transactions were being purchased outright by single entities and then transferred. What we've got here is, I believe, and I'd like, and other people have said the same thing, including the man from GATA, Mr. Murphy, who's been on this program. He said that there's been gold hoarding from special interests around the world, and they are buying gold left, right, and center, and ultimately they're going to control all the gold again. And it will not be in the treasuries as it once was of individual states, but rather in the hands of this single group. Now, no wonder Mr. Ron Paul wants us to go back to the gold standard, because he's not working for the people. He's working for the best interests of this cartel that has built this huge position in physical gold. And, of course, once these fiat systems fully implode, the only rational system that the public will accept will probably be a return to a gold standard, which, by the way, they will be in full control of. And it seems to me that we're on the precipice of this. But let's talk a little bit about Mr. Rothschild's manipulation of gold, and actually his continuation through the Jewish mafia of controlling gold. Because before Mr. Rothschild was fixing the price of gold, his cronies within that system were actually controlling most of its transaction. Were they not?
What happened, Darrell, is once in the early 1970s, we completely separated the dollar from any link to gold, and then we used the dollar as the benchmark for valuing European currencies as opposed to any other mechanism. This was the mechanism which came into play. Gold then became largely irrelevant in the sense of it wasn't required for monetary issue by central banks. So what we now have is that gold went from being a currency, went from being a money to being a commodity. And it was rebranded a commodity at that stage. Now, in spite of it being unimportant and a commodity, a very strange set of events occurred whereby the world gold price, rather than being out on an open market with central banks obviously doing their various transactions, it found its way, and this is absolute provable, demonstrable historical fact, and I'll explain why this is demonstrable in a moment as well now. It found its way into the offices of N.M. Rothschild and Sons in the City of London.
But now let's give a little sidebar here. I hate interrupting you when you do this, but when a huge gold discovery was made in South Africa, it was Rothschild back in the early beginning of the last century during the Boer War period, which he actually told England to go down there and beat up on the Afrikaner group and take that country over. He sent down his second man, Oppenheimer, to go down and consolidate control over this huge gold field that had been discovered. Why? Because it would undermine the monopolistic status that he was establishing at the beginning of the last century. And so what did they do? They used the British Army and British soldiers and British power, sounds like today, by the way, to go down there and consolidate control over a huge find of gold. And then and so what it does is it demonstrates this man's interest in having a monopolist control over the use and hoarding and control of gold, and then move it forward till the last 30 years, he was actually fixing the price of gold in his office. Now, why don't we give the rest of that story then?
Well, the interesting thing, Dal, is, you know, that the rest of the world has been told officially by Nixon and the governments of the world that gold is now unimportant, it doesn't matter, we're going to issue currencies without it, we're going to have genuine fiat currencies, currencies backed by government promise only. And the price of gold doesn't matter, gold's just a commodity like copper or lead or zinc. So at the time that everybody's being told that, we find that once it's out of the public view, once the pricing of gold is out of the limelight, no longer the stuff of central banks and governments, it found its way into the offices of a Mr. N.M. Rothschild and Sons, whereby the pricing mechanism worked as follows, Darrell. There was a pentagon-shaped table, a table with five sides. At one side sits Mr. Rothschild, or his representative for that day, and the other four persons are representatives from London banks, who are still in the gold market. And what would happen is there would be a little bit of bid and offer across the table between these people, and then the price for that day would be set. It was, and this is crucial for everybody to understand, this mechanism by which Mr. Rothschild became the sole price for world gold in the City of London was only disbanded, Darrell, within the last 8 years. This isn't something ancient history now that we're describing. This is only 8 years ago that this fell apart. And the reason it fell apart is because of something which came into being known as the European System of Central Banks, the ESCB, which was the precursor to the European Central Bank. So what happened was that a system of central banks, a new network between the central banks, was put in place, which had at its head a committee that managed the European system.
And that's right. And the Germans which, held the largest sway in that whole
exactly.
board structure.
And then, once the euro was about to come into being, we formed the ECB, the European Central Bank, which was the bank making the promises on the new currency.